Hello and welcome to another episode of Unofficial Partner, the Sports Business Podcast. I'm Richard Gillis. You might know Utilita Energy from the front of Luton Town's shirt. The journey of the newly promoted club is one of the stories of the Premier League season. But there's so much more to the company than that. Luton and Utilita have partnered since 2015, back when the club was still in the fourth tier of English football, before they became front of shirt sponsor in February 2022. But that's just one part of a comprehensive and wide-ranging sponsorship strategy that uses football to educate fans and club owners about how to tackle energy poverty. Our guest is Jem Maidman, Chief Marketing Officer of Utilita Energy. And joining Jem is Sean Watling of Red Mandarin. So together we unpick the strategy that drives one of football's most prolific and innovative sponsors.
I was at the three party conferences last September and October. You know, Labour, Lib Dem and Conservative, we were lobbying and stuff on fuel poverty. Every single one, we had MPs and SPADs and blah blah coming up. And the first thing they said is Luton Town. And they were animated and wanted to talk about us. That's the power. I was always very reluctant to have a front of shirt in the Premier League because it's very cost prohibitive and we're not rolling in money by any stretch of the imagination. But also you lose so much of that value. It goes out of the country, frankly, and we only operate in England, Scotland and Wales. I think that it's such a wonderful story and our values are absolutely aligned with Luton's in the sense that we're both challenger brands in some ways. We've both been on a journey where we've been kicked and battered and smacked around the head and we've still got up, dusted ourselves off and moved on to the next stage. And I'm immensely proud of how we've done that at Utilita. We haven't broken the bank. We've done it all properly. And that's exactly the same at Luton. So as I said, you speak to people and 9 times out of 10, they want to talk about Luton Town. It's brilliant. It's wonderful. I've got a big smile on my face.
Sport Accord World Sport and Business Summit is taking place in the UK this year at Birmingham's ICC from the 7th to the 11th of April. Global leaders and senior executives from over 125 international sports federations, the IOC, rights holders, professional leagues, host cities, and major event organising committees from all continents will be meeting to make decisions that will shape the future of sport. With a thought-provoking conference programme, busy exhibition, and a host of networking events, evening receptions, and cultural activities, Sport Accord is your chance to organise a year's worth of meetings in a week with executives from across the global sport ecosystem. Senior execs from FIBA to Fortnite, from the FIA to Kansas City Chiefs. Don't miss the chance to rub shoulders with the world's sports and business leaders. Visit sportaccord.sport for more information. And as a listener to Unofficial Partner Podcast, you can claim a 10% discount off the ticket price for Sport Accord. Just go to the show notes or the newsletter for more details on that. Let's talk about you for a minute. How did you get into this? What's your job?
Okay, so my name is Jem Maidman, and I'm the Chief Marketing Officer at Utilita Energy. And my background is certainly not marketing in any way, shape, or form. I have no qualifications in marketing. Let's make that clear from the off. Communication is my bag. I started as a journalist back in 91, 92, and was a journalist for 18 years, so I did the usual thing of, I didn't go to university. I was going to go to university to do journalism up in, I think it was Lancaster I was going to go to. And a lot of actually, from the year I was going, there was a lot of very, very good journalists were on that course. And I just worked in local news. I worked for free on a local newspaper for 6 months and worked at Burger King at night because you could do that then. I think it's probably a very different landscape 30 years on to how it was then. Yeah. And then I sort of progressed through regional press, went to a paper called the Hammond High, the sort of posh paper in North London, the self-titled best local newspaper in Britain. And then from there, I went to Teletext, which was an absolutely brilliant job, made some amazing contacts and wouldn't have swapped that for all the tea in China. It was an amazing job. I try and explain it to my kids. You know, it was the 80s internet, wasn't it, really? 80s and 90s internet, but I worked on the sports desk there. I was never really a sports journalist as such. Well, I was, but news was always my passion. But I did work on the sports desk there, and great, and I've made some friends for life there. And then some of the best journalists I worked with the Teletext as well. And then I was at Sky News for six, seven years. And I was a producer there, and I ended up being chief sub-editor on the morning show. Sunrise, I forgot what it was called there, with Raymond Holmes. And then when I left, I was, for my last few months, I was editing the 1 o'clock news show there. I left there in 2010 and wanted to work in public relations. I just wanted to change, I think, the media landscape and how we digest news, as we all know, has completely changed. That's why newspapers, you know, you see double-digit percentage decreases in sales every year, and has been like that for the last 15 years because of the internet, and then there's everything else that comes with it. Even things like TikTok are now becoming an extremely powerful way of disseminating news. And
what was Eamon Holmes like?
Great guy, lovely fellow, yeah. It's weird, actually, because, you know, I was producing that show, and effectively, it's the hardest job in Sky News. I will say that if there's anyone from Sky News listening to this, it is. It's chief sub-editor of the morning show, because you have to start. You obviously, it's a 24-hour rolling news channel, but you have to start afresh at 6 a.m. So everything else is kind of disregarded. Well, you know, there's a rule of thumb. So you're news gathering through the night, which is not a very good time when you need to get someone to talk about, you know, something that's happening at 2 a.m. People tend to go asleep then, sensible people anyway. But Eamon was great. He was an extraordinary pro. And because he's got this kind of calm demeanor and this sort of, you know, people kind of maybe don't realize just what an absolutely staggeringly brilliant journalist he is. And he is. And the perfect example of that is when there'd be a breaking news story, Eamon would just be coming out with facts and figures. And I'm thinking, I haven't written this. And it's up there. It's up there. And that's, you know, it's a sink or swim when there's a big breaking news story. And people like Eamon very, very, very much are swimmers, not sinkers.
So build a bridge there from that to where you are now then. How did you get into the, we're going to talk about sport and sponsorship. So,
I mean, I'd previously, you know, I say I'm not a sports journalist. I mean, I had obviously worked in sport on and off. You know, it's a passion. News was very much my passion. But, you know, I did a lot of work for Arsenal back in 2000, I was chief reporter on the Hammond High newspaper and the Islington edition. And this is all relevant, so I will try and skim over it. But basically,
if anything about Arsenal is ever relevant, really,
it's always relevant
in the broader sense.
But at the time, you may recall Arsenal announced they're intending to move to shiny new stadium in what was then known as Ashburton Grove, which was a rubbish tip. Or waste transfer station is the prospect.
Just make themselves.
And you can insert your own gag there, can't you? And so, as it was a news story rather than a sports journal story, I kind of took the story on. So I got to know Ken Fryer, who's one of the most remarkable people I've ever met. People don't know Ken Fryer, he's worked for Arsenal since 1947 and is still an employee, by the way. Mm-hmm. And got his first job at Arsenal by kicking a ball against a car outside the East Stand on Avenel Road, and a man came out and reprimanded him. And it was at the time a chap called George Allison, the first team manager. And I think Ken cried and said sorry. It was about 12 or 13 at the time. And they gave him a job out of pity or something, sort of match day messenger boy. Rose to managing director and is a wonderful, wonderful human being. I could talk about him all day. But anyway, I got to know him and he said, look, you know, we're launching a magazine. You know, you can write, you know your stuff. Do you want to, can you contribute? And I said, yeah. So I got to know everyone at the club, and then I ended up writing two or three books for the club, two and a half really. So I wrote some books for official books for the club, which I'm happy to send you a copy. I know you'll devour them. And then when I left journalism, I wanted to, and there was a number of reasons. As I say, I think the main thing was I just wasn't, the way that news was and the immediacy of news, I thought that sometimes quality was being compromised. I still stand by that. And I wanted to try something else, and transferable skills as a journalist are normally public relations and some kind of comms role. So I worked in two or three comms roles and then eventually ended up at Utilita in 2015. I was doing some consultancy work for a company called H&K Strategies, who a lot of people on who listen to these podcasts know.
Hill and Knowlton.
I think they've just gone back to Hill and Knowlton.
The Hill and Knowlton name, I think, has disappeared now. I think I'm right in saying that they've subsumed that within something else. I think it's Burson or something like that. I can't remember.
Is that right? Goodness.
Yeah, yeah. There was a sort of outpouring on LinkedIn of former Hill and Knowlton employees, of which there are quite a few, obviously.
Well, my wife is one. My wife is a former Hill and Knowlton, so I'll have to inform her that. She'll be gutted.
Yeah, yeah. There's a wake, or they're holding drinks in its honour. You know, there's all these Hill and Knowlton people coming out. You know, it's like a sort of, there'll be candles held up, all of that.
Well, they had Hill and Knowlton used to have great offices in Soho Square, right next to the FA's old offices.
That's right.
I don't know if you recall that back in 20 years. And I think they moved to shiny offices somewhere in Farringdon, I think, which are very, very fun.
Well, they were in Clerkenwell Green, and they have got a lovely rooftop bar, which is absolutely sensational.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's still there. I hope they've kept that. And, you know, I don't, the name is one thing, but the bar is separate.
Yeah, yeah. But it's a very, well, it's a huge company for anyone who knows who Hill & Knowlton or H&K, whatever they're calling themselves this week. I was doing a bit of consulting then, a bit of freelance work and what have you, and I was sort of pottering around. I'd previously been at William Hill. And then this position at Utilita came up. I'd never heard of them, had no intention of going. And at the time, Utilita was one of those, you would have seen, I mean, there's been the big energy crisis over the last few years, so people would be acutely aware of. And a lot of these challenger brands, I mean, 31 energy suppliers have ceased trading since back in the 2020, early 21. And a lot of them were like Utilita. They were startups that were trying to challenge the big boys. And that's exactly what Utilita was at the time. I think we had about 120,000 customers, 100 million turnover. We're now a 2 billion turnover. We've got 840,000 customers. If it wasn't for the energy crisis and everything, we would have certainly been well over a million now, but we're moving in that direction. And so this role came up and I was kind of like, okay, and I live in Bedfordshire. The role was down in Winchester, but it just seemed to, when I spoke to the CEO, the fact he's an Arsenal season ticket holder had nothing to do with it, but I want to make that clear. I want to knock that on the head. It just seemed a really compelling story. And a bit like John Riley, the former head of news at Sky News, always used to say, you know, we should be challenging the status quo. And I saw similarities, as odd as it may seem, with Sky News at its best. And I think it is the best news channel. But I would say that's next Sky. And then I saw what Utilita were trying to do. They're just trying to do things differently. And they've got a real heart. And I just thought, you know what, I'm gonna go in and jump in feet first. And the same day, I won't name the business, but I got offered another job on far more money, a lot closer to home. And my wife said, what are you doing? And it's been the best thing I've ever done in my career. I couldn't be happier.
Sean, I'll bring you in here because I've just changed my, literally this week, and I can't, I'm now trying to remember who I've changed from and to, but I think it's Octopus.
Okay.
And I think it's because someone heard him on the radio. It was as random as that. But that whole marketplace feels, it's always been one that you think, well, actually, I'm just stuck with these people forever. I've got very little choice. And in terms of the brands that are in that world and that category, before we start talking about Utilita, let's talk about that sort of market.
Yeah.
And in relation to sponsorship, I can sort of think of things that have happened. What's your take, Sean, more broadly on the category?
Well, I think, I mean, it goes back to the deregulations, isn't it? When they split sort of supply, distribution, and production of electricity, and all of the branded suppliers came in to leverage a brand against a large market. And I think that it's always been a tough, I mean, Jem has got a lot to say on this. It's always been a tough market, and it's only got tougher.
I mean, I think I just need to set the scene here because we've kind of skirted around it. But, you know, the first thing to say, and one of the reasons I took this role is because the reputation of energy companies is not particularly good. There are huge reputational challenges that the sector has, not just us. I think it's grossly unfair, and I will stand by that. And the thing with energy is it's become a bit of a political football. And I even remember going back to my Sky days, by the way, when, you know, British Gas had put their prices up by 7%. And the first thing we would do is try out the same imagery of the old lady, you know, hobbling to the stove to put a hot chocolate on and the gas coming on. And, you know, look what these people are doing. And I've got a very different view. Now I work in the energy sector and I understand the challenges, the regulatory challenges are extraordinary. And I've worked in tobacco and gambling. So, you know, I will be going to hell at some stage, I'm sure, briefly in both. And they were both very interesting roles and very interesting sectors to work in. The regulatory environment in those is a doddle, I would suggest, compared to energy. I think that it's quite an extraordinary environment. A lot of these energy companies were formed to try and, as I say, challenge the big boys. And I think, you know, they've done some great work. We've been fantastic for the energy sector. We've innovated. We've got an app that is, by an absolute country mile, industry leading, that has won numerous awards. We particularly target customers who, you know, I'm going to say this, and I know this is being recorded, but I would say this, I think that we target a lot of customers that no other suppliers really want. They're financially or socially challenged. And we don't believe that they have been treated fairly. My CEO set the business up 21 years ago for that exact reason. He was a director at Gas previously, and you know, he's vastly experienced. And we just didn't feel that that a lot of these customers, the lower end, the lower rung, if you like, were being treated fairly. They were sometimes on the most expensive tariffs. They were ignored. And so, you know, I mean, you know, we're a smart prepaid company, just to give context as well. So we have 92% of our customers have a smart meter. There is a smart meter rollout, which I think could be going a lot better. A government IT project that's not going swimmingly, I would have thought it, but you know, we're 92% installed our customers. They're almost predominantly prepay. Again, the reputational issues around that are completely unfounded. For what it's worth, and I want to say this, it's actually the cheapest tariff out there. The cheapest way to pay for your energy is prepay. It's not by a direct debit. It's certainly not by pay on receipt. That's about 150, 200 quid a year more. And actually, you know, an awful lot of customers, social group DE, that kind of lower rung socially, financially, are on those really high tariffs. You know, things like pay on receipt of bill. So, you know, you get your bill and pay it in 28 days. So we just want to continue doing what we're doing.
I think I always find it useful and interesting just to get into the dynamics of the business and the category. And that marketplace question, what that leads to in terms of the sort of marketing decisions that you then might, is that the reason the business was set up, that you targeted that marketplace?
100%. Or yeah, that's exactly, I mean, you know, Bill set it up for the reasons are very simple, very compelling. He felt the people were not getting a fair deal, and they were the people who were the ones who had anxiety over their bills, who were petrified when the bill would hit the mat every 3 months, and they thought, well, I can't pay this. You know, the reality is that there is 10 million people, up to 10 million households in this country that you could argue are fuel poor. I mean, our assessments go from about 6.8 million to 10 million, depending on how you slice it up. There is an affordability gap of up to £1,000 in this country. And what that means is that there are people, there are millions of households out there that have that gap of up to £1,000 of what they need and what they actually have to heat their homes. Just, I mean, we're talking about the basics here. We're talking about heating your home, about having hot water, about being able to put a light on, all the things that we take for granted. The only time you know about an energy company is when you can't put your light on or whatever. Then it's a bit like a referee in football. You don't know it's a good one, but you know it's a bad ref, don't you? Yeah. A good ref just, you know, this, so, and unfortunately, because of the situation we're currently in, we slipped into recession again, I understand, the last few days or what have you as well. And there was a huge affordability issue. Energy bills are still nearly £2,000 a year. I mean, the price cap on the 1st of April, we anticipate, will come down by about £300. But even then, that is still 60, 70% higher than pre-September 21 when the energy crisis kicked off. And this isn't going away. And I think people need to wake up to it. And the people who need to wake up to it more than anything is those people in Westminster who seem to be completely blind to this. And I count all sides in this as well. I count whether you're red, blue, whatever, there is a huge problem out there and it seems to be swept under the carpet and it concerns me greatly. And it gives us a utility sleepless nights and others in the sector as well, not just us. We want people to be able to afford to pay for their energy and have a good service and not have that anxiety. But it lies with the government. There's an affordability issue. And there's only so much energy suppliers can do.
What happened with the Liz Truss moment where you had this energy price cap? I wonder what the implications of that were, how the industry responded to that.
So I might have been asleep or blinked when Liz Truss was Prime Minister. I can't remember. sorry, that was cheap, wasn't it? I mean, sorry, are you referring to the energy price guarantee?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the energy price guarantee was actually a very good thing. It's one of the few things, it's in that thin band of things that this government has done well as regards to helping energy customers. So for those of you who don't understand it, hey, listen, I'm sure you're rubbing your hands and glee, all this talk about energy, everyone. But what the energy price guarantee effectively did is because the wholesale prices were going up so considerably, I mean, again, just to give it context, pre-September 21, the average energy, the price cap was about £1,100 a year, so just under £100 a month. It went up to about £4,500 a year at one stage because wholesale prices were going through the roof. Another thing I really want to make the point here as well is us retailers weren't making money out of it. People thinking, oh, my bills are going up and these, and we weren't making money. We're paying way over the odds for this energy as well. And we have to pass that on. So there was no profit in it, certainly not from our customers. And I would argue we haven't actually really made a penny's profit out of our customers since April 2017 when the price cap came in. But the price guarantee, what that did is it set it at £2,500. So anything over that, the government effectively paid for, which was a very costly thing to do. Although actually the prices came down quite quickly. So I think the government set aside, I mean, who knows, you know, depending on who you speak to, you get different figures. I mean, I heard up to 150 billion quid to pay for this. They certainly didn't spend anywhere near that, not even half, probably not even a third. And I don't know the figures, but I'm sure they don't as well. So that was there to protect people. So it was a very good thing. It was a very, very good thing the government did. What the government should have done is done that again this winter, and they haven't. And they should have done EBS payments, which is what they did last year when every household got £400, which was staggered over 6 months. And they didn't do that this year. We actually said we didn't think that they should do that this year, but because everyone got that. It was a broad brush. Everybody got £400. Now, I'm in a really fortunate position. I didn't need that £400. I'm very lucky. But millions did need that. I'd rather give my £400 to someone else. In fact, I donated it to charity, and I think a lot of us did, to Utility Giving, our charity, by the way. But what the government needed to do this year was just to target those 10 million homes, or estimate 10 million homes in fuel poverty, and to give them that £400, but they failed to do that. You can see I'm angry about this, guys, and I'm going.
Yeah, no, and it's good to see, because normally it's sort of my in my imagination an energy supplier is, I don't know about you, Sean, but I think I don't think of it as angry. I think of sort of fairly complacent, faceless bureaucrats. So it's quite nice to not have that.
And I guess not helped by profits from people like British Gas being reported as super high, coinciding with all of the consumer hardship as well.
The last thing I'm going to do is defend British Gas or Shell or anything. They're not my that's not out of my remit. Right? I'm here to defend and to protect utilities' reputation and say about all the good things we do. The only thing I would say, and it is just worth pointing this out as well, is that those companies were making hideous losses as well. Not too long ago, we're talking about billions in losses. So it is a bit of an evening up. Again, wholesale prices are dictating that. There's been lots of winners in this. You know, the Norwegian state, for example, if you want to really scratch the surface, they've been making an awful lot of money out of this, but seem to have, it doesn't help us, because unfortunately the problem we have is that people see us as the same as British Gas or Shell. They're the generators. They generate the energy and sell it at a huge profit. We're the ones who buy it off them and make no money out of it. The margin, Ofgem will tell you there's a margin. You know, I'm sorry, there is not a margin. You know, if you want to get someone from Ofgem on here and we can really turn off the rest of your viewers, I'm more than happy to do that. There is no margin in us selling energy at the moment. In fact, I would say it's probably -1% or so. I don't know what it is, but who knows? But there is no margin at the moment, believe me. Anyway, I'm Zen. Okay. I'm Zen.
You don't sound Zen. So, Sean, what are the questions then we should be asking, where we bring it back to the sort of sponsorship question?
Well, I guess there's a number of questions I wanted to put to Jem. One is around the, obviously, you've had multiple sponsorships. I'm interested in how you've transitioned from being, it looks like, across 10 shirts to, is it just in all exposure in Luton now? Or is there anything?
No,
you've got a few still, haven't you?
Huddersfield Town, Bristol Rovers. We've got a few. We're still very much out there. We've got a number of football partners in varying degrees, and they all vary for different reasons, whether it's a geographical reason, it's an area that we're targeting. Sometimes it's just pure old brand awareness, you know, and there's no real science behind it. I mean, let's not try and over-egg this. You know, we're not reinventing the wheel here.
The main school of thought when people buying sponsorships seems to be buy as big as you can afford, but there's another completely different school of thought, which is buy tactically in terms of kind of low cost shirt exposure for brand awareness. And you seem to be, where do you sit in that?
Our very first football partnership was with the Scottish League Cup. And that was a very specific reason that we did that. I'd just joined the business and my CEO had charged me with growing the brand. At the time, our brand awareness was, 1% if we were very lucky. No one really knew who we were. And it's currently about 30-odd%. I'm 35%, I'm not quite sure. I mean, it's grown hugely and we're very proud that football's been a massive part of that. The reason we started the Scottish League Cup is because we were targeting the central belt of Scotland and no one knew who we were. And I said to my CEO, Bill, why don't we do this as a kind of a test, really? So it was kind of, we obviously went into increasing our brand awareness and our brand sentiment. And look, to be honest with you, it worked a treat. Our sales went through the roof in the Central Belt. We didn't have the most, no disrespect to Ross County, because Ross County won it that year. It was a wonderful story and a brilliant occasion. You obviously hope for a Celtic Rangers or a Rangers Aberdeen or something like that. And it was Ross County beat Hibs. And we are a partner of Hibernian. And I know Ben, the CEO, very well, is a good mate. So he wasn't the CEO then. But, you know, and actually, you know, it was a wonderful occasion, but it really worked for us. And we did, obviously, the usual thing of a brand study before and a brand study 6 months later, and the difference was tangible. And again, even our face-to-face sales guys were going to the door, and the first thing people said, oh, the Scottish League Cup. Oh, who are you cheering? We know who you are. Again, there's no science behind this, but that proved to me the power of football sponsorship and where we could go with it.
And that was your test case with Bill, was it really?
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. It was exactly that. And, you know, look, I'm pushing an open door with Bill because he's a big football fan and a rugby fan. He loves his rugby. He used to play for Blackheath back in the 80s and 90s, I think. But also he is a big football fan. So, you know, he got it straight away. I mean, actually, there was a bit of reluctance for him at one point because, you know, utility, just to go back to those days, we were still in a pre-fledgling state and, you know, could have gone either way, really, you know, in the sense that, you know, a lot of these suppliers came and went very quickly. So at the time, it was a low six figures that we were paying. It was still a big financial commitment for us. So there was a little bit of a squeaky bum time, to use a footballing parlance. But I think once we'd got over that and thought, well, let's just go in feet first and see where we go with this. And as I said, it was brilliant. And I couldn't have been happier. I'm so proud of what we did with the Scottish League Cup and how we activated it as well.
But you've dotted in and out of lots of different clubs, haven't you? Quite unusually, I'd say, in as much as you've had deals with probably about 20 clubs now over the last kind of since you've been there, it feels like. And that, so what's driving that? Is that around tactics and around getting a kind of a good deal?
Everything, yeah. It is. It's sometimes you look, you know, one thing I've learned in this crazy sponsorship world is that everyone, the values can vary greatly. That's the first thing to say. You know, what one chief commercial officer at one football club thinks they're worth, it can vary massively from another football club of a similar size and what have you. So we did do a bit of shopping round, but really, again, you know, we really did look at, we were looking at certain areas. I mean, there were some things. We've had a partnership with Southampton for 6 years or 7 years. That is a purely a local thing because we are based in Eastleigh. In fact, we sponsor Eastleigh with a front of shirt and have been for 6 or 7 years there as well. And they're terrific. You know, that really was for our staff because the bulk of our staff, or a large chunk of our staff, are based in the Solent area. We obviously have done some work with Pompey as well. But we've also, you know, we have targeted areas again. You know, Sunderland is a good example of that. You know, we really wanted to target the Northeast. It was a big area for us to grow our business, and it has worked a treat. And certainly, you know, on our side and that, you know, we've seen our customer numbers grow quite significantly. And it's no coincidence that has coincided with us having a really deep, meaningful partnership with Sunderland.
Can you talk a bit about the Luton relationship? Because yeah, obviously they're, you know that story when a club goes up and then suddenly say, oh, the shirt must be worth blah, blah, blah. That whole meme, which is part of the sports business sort of folklore. Take us through. What happens?
Well, I mean, the first thing to say, and I live in not too far from Luton. I live between Luton and Bedford, so I've got to watch myself. Everyone's Luton around here. And they still remind me of the 88 Lords Cup final, for those of a long memory, which is horrible. As does Gary Sweet, their CEO. So we talked. Initially what had happened is that obviously we'd worked with Luton on a relatively low level. And then in February 22, we actually went front of shirt. They'd had an issue with the previous sponsor. And so we kind of stepped in. And the first game was actually Chelsea in the Cup on BBC. So it was, you know, nice. It was just, you know, a wonderful, wonderful opportunity for us. And at the time, you could see Luton were definitely moving that direction. I was convinced they were going to be a Premier League team within 3 years. It's an extraordinary club with a wonderful story that I think supersedes the Leicester City story in 2016, to be honest with you, when you think about where Luton had to come from. And they've done it without spending. They don't spend a penny they haven't got. So I love that as well. We had the discussion. So I kind of tentatively said, well, look, you know, guys, if you go up, you know, where do we go from here kind of thing? And so the commercial director there, Chris Bell, who is a wonderful guy and just, you know, one of the very best in the business. We had these conversations. I went in with an offer and said, you know, this is what we'd be willing to pay. And there was basically a handshake on it. And we said, okay. And at the time, you know, they didn't go up. They got knocked out in the playoffs the previous year. And then that kind of just stayed. And as we got closer last season, it was like, well, this is getting real. even in the Premier League, wow, you know. And so we had those conversations kind of kicked off again. Look, you know, if they'd have gone with a betting company, they would have got a lot more. And it wouldn't be fair for me to start talking figures. I certainly wouldn't do that. But what I would say is that I know that betting companies were coming into Luton Town and offering far more than we were. And I'm talking two times, three times maybe. But, you know, one of the reasons that we stayed with Luton Town is because, you know, we got what we felt was a very good and fair price. Luton don't want to work with betting companies. They don't want to work with crypto. And although I, as a former head of PR at William Hill, have a slightly different view on that, I do get it. And I think that's definitely the direction of travel. And I admired one thing they have got is you know, great values the club has. And Gary Sweet, the CEO, who is a legend in football, not just in Bedfordshire, you know, what he's done for that club and the team around him to pull them out of the absolute mire. And he kind of, you know, he's not money grabbing. He wants to do the right thing for the football club. So when I found that very compelling as well. We wanted to be part of their story as well. We didn't want it to end when it got to the best bit, and it has been the best bit. So
One of the questions I was going to ask is what you've noticed, you know, since this season, what from the business perspective?
Well, I'll tell you what now. You want to talk about Luton Town. I mean, even when we had these discussions before, you talked about Luton Town. I was at the three-party conferences last September and October. You know, Labour, Lib Dem and Conservative, we were lobbying and stuff on fuel poverty, but I won't get into that again. And every single one, we had MPs and SPADs and blah-de-blah coming up. And the first thing they said is Luton Town. And they were animated and wanted to talk about us. That's the power. I was always very reluctant to have a front of shirt in the Premier League because it's very cost prohibitive and we're not rolling money by any stretch of the imagination. But also you lose so much of that value. It goes out of the country, frankly. And we only operate in England, Scotland and Wales. And we hope that changes. I mean, you know, at some stage we want to be an international brand and all of these kind of things. But, you know, ultimately that's where we operate. So if someone in Thailand sees our brand, it doesn't mean anything. It's lovely. And, you know, I've been on holiday in Greece and watched and seen, you know, our brand on TV and it's a great thrill, but it doesn't actually bring in any business for us. But again, you know, I think that it's such a wonderful story and our values are absolutely aligned with Luton's in the sense that, you know, we're both challenger brands in some ways. Mm. You know, we've both been on a journey where, you know, we've been kicked and battered and smacked around the head and we've still got up, dusted ourselves off and moved on to the next stage. And I'm immensely proud of how we've done that at Utility. So we haven't broken the bank. We've done it all properly. And that's exactly the same with Luton. So, and, you know, as I said, you speak to people and 9 times out of 10, they want to talk about Luton Town. I was up at Rangers. I went to the Celtic Hibs game the other week and I was at Rangers. And on both occasions, people up there, Scottish football administrators and fans, they want to talk about Luton Town. It's brilliant. It's wonderful. I've got a big smile on my face.
Can I ask a question about brand stuff, brand metrics, Jem? Because obviously I can see the awareness and I can see especially targeting through certain clubs and areas where you're looking to penetrate. But you're targeting the meter market and you're pretty much the only business that really is focused on that and dedicated to that segment of the market.
Smart meters, sorry.
Yeah. And so all of your communications around kind of value and saving money and saving, you know, saving energy, but primarily saving money. So your proposition is entirely lined up against your audience. What part does football play in increasing your kind of improving brand sentiment?
Look, never underestimate the positive impact of having, you know, a good sponsorship the football club has, particularly when it comes to brand sentiment. If you're talking about our energy efficiency campaigns, when we've been running a highly successful campaign since December 2019 called Energy High Five, 5 Ways to Save Energy. Other suppliers have now belatedly got on board with that. There is one much bigger supplier than us is now saying, hey, we're the only energy company that's telling you to use less energy. Look, we've been doing that for 20 years, frankly, because the whole point of a smart meter is to, you have visibility and you can reduce your energy spend and you can, you know, you've got the power kind of thing. So what we do, I mean, if you look at what we've done with our football clubs and with that energy efficiency piece, because it's so important. It's central to our messaging and everything that we do, not just in football. We have music arenas and what have you as well, is to educate people. So if you look at things like, for example, Hibernian's a really good example. And I mentioned Ben Kensel, I mean, Murray Milligan there, who was a great guy, and they're really on board and they want to help. And they genuinely want to help educate their fans. And our potential customers. So we do a lot of work with things like we've got a partnership with Iceland, the retailer, and we do stuff like air fryers and how they can save your energy. And obviously it's much healthier to eat using cooking with an air fryer. So we've used their players to do some really interesting activations that they've really got on board with as well. We did one last year at Christmas, and we cooked a Christmas dinner in an air fryer for four of the players. And it was so brilliantly received. And the players, again, I can't thank them enough, because they really jumped in and really enjoyed it. Well, they got a free meal out of it as well, you know. I think it was like a fight. It cost a fiver each head. Using Iceland ingredients, I hasten to add as well. I should give them a plug. But and it was so well received. And what that's done for us, if you talk about brand sentiment, I like to think when I speak to Hibernian supporters, they will say things like, and this always comes back to what I said, when I first started Utilita in 2015, I said, however long I'm here for, if I can leave and people say Utilita, they're all right, they are. That's good enough for me. Because energy, we start at a disadvantage in the energy sector anyway. Mm. Doesn't sound very ambitious. And I have Hibernian fans come up to me and say, you lot really cared. And, I mean, that sounds a bit schmaltzy, but it happens to be the truth. You know, you guys are really good. You really care. You know, you're really trying to make a difference. And that, for me, is so powerful. It's so potent. And so... that's, you know, if we can really leverage our clubs and the assets that we're given, and sometimes they're quite frugal clubs and they don't want to give you too much, but others like, again, Hibernian are just magnificent, Southampton, those kind of clubs, Palace, Crystal Palace have been brilliant for us as well.
And can you give us an overview in terms of how you're activating against the clubs? Because I know you've got different things going on, different initiatives all over the place. You've got the energy hubs. I think you mentioned energy hub opening up in Huddersfield.
Yep.
Is there a kind of a plan or a matrix about what you do where? Because you seem to be doing lots and lots of stuff, but it's difficult to get an overall sense of pattern for it.
Yeah, I mean, the hubs are very important to us. And so just to explain them, we're the only energy supplier in the country that actually has high street presence. We've got 11 hubs at the moment, and what they essentially are is they're places you can go and have free coffee, get energy efficiency advice, top up your meter while you're there, buy very, very low-cost energy efficiency products. But what we do, and you just mentioned Huddersfield there, we've opened one up in the centre of Huddersfield, and we've worked with Huddersfield Town on that. So there is the education piece about energy efficiency and what have you. But also Huddersfield love us because we're sending some of their shirts for them. They don't have a town centre presence. We're just about to do a similar one in Luton as well. We're hopefully going to open that. Well, hopefully Q1, it may slip into Q2 this year. So we work with a lot of the football clubs, Southampton. We've got one in Shirley, which is a suburb of Southampton. We've got one in near Portsmouth, a place called Gosport, which is a strong Pompey area. And we work with the football clubs on promoting those hubs. They will have a presence there. They'll send players down. They'll do all the usual stuff that we can do. But ultimately, those hubs really are there to not just help Utilita customers. That's not what we're about. We want to help everyone. So you can be an OVO customer or a British Gas customer, and you can come and have a free coffee. We're happy to give you energy efficiency advice. So those hubs are very, very important to how we activate with certain football clubs. I think that's, a very important part of our strategy.
And one of the things, obviously, in sports environmental movement is around how do you activate or how do you leverage fan groups to create change? Because sports promises the ability to kind of energize and connect with kind of billions of people. And so if you can engage that audience with an environmental message, then sport has a huge power to do that. Are you actively targeting the whole fan groups of the town, of the clubs? And are you tracking their sort of engagement in any way with Utilita or energy inefficiency?
Do you know what? Well, the first thing to say about that is I've always been a bit reluctant to actually target the fan supporters groups and stuff, because they would always be a bit naturally suspicious, I think, anyway. I'm a football fan. I've been going since the 80s. And if I was, in the Arsenal supporters club and sponsors started approaching us or approaching me, I would be a bit, as I say, reluctant to engage with them. But certainly, what we do stuff through. I mean, well, how can I really answer? That's quite an interesting one. I mean, we do speak to fans. A lot of the stuff that we do, as regards to energy efficiency, we try actually, in a way, to target through the kids and through the younger supporters. Because, to be honest with you, there's a nod to Greta Thunberg here, but actually younger people we see, and this is a terrible sweeping generalization, but they seem to be a bit more concerned about the environment. I say that my kids still don't turn lights off when they leave the room, which grinds my gears. But we, you know, so you may have seen with a lot of football clubs, we do, we have the children's shirts when they've got a betting sponsor or whatever. And we take children's retail front shirt. And what we do is we engage with younger fans and do energy efficiency stuff. We do competitions with them, you know, all the kind of usual stuff that you would expect. So I don't know how to answer that really. I mean, yeah, you know, there's so much going on, but that's essentially what we do. So we do, I mean, I wouldn't say, do we measure it? Probably not to a great extent. A lot of it really is more about sort of word of mouth. And obviously we do our brand sentiment studies at the end of seasons and that kind of stuff. So that probably picks it up to an extent as well.
I've got a question about the Southampton, the naming rights deal, which I think I can now join the links to, because obviously it's a local deal.
Are you talking about Hampshire cricket?
Yes. You've preempted the question by laying the groundwork for talking about, you know, where the company sits and the locality of it. But let's just talk about the naming rights deal at the cricket club.
Well, that's a very simple answer to that. Ageas has been a brilliant partner of Hampshire cricket and the bowl for 12 or 13 years. And we've had a sort of low-level partnership at the venue for probably 5 or 6 years now, because we have a lot of staff days and teams days and stuff there. So we use it. And you know, a lot of our staff down there will go and watch Hampshire, or they'll go to the Southern Braves and that. It's brilliant. It's a wonderful venue. It's going to be a test, Ashes test venue in 27 for the men, 2031 for the women. So, you know, we were speaking to the chief executive, David Mann, for a long time beforehand. And we kind of thought it just coming out. But my thing has always been, you know, this has been a great, this whole thing that we've kind of set up at Utility has been a great brand awareness exercise, right? And not much more in many ways. And obviously it's grown our brand awareness and our sentiment. But, and I know this is, everyone will say this, but I really wanted a proper collaboration. I want us to leave a legacy. So that's Seb Coe here with the Olympics. And what is really compelling about what we're doing here and you know, we have very strong net zero targets ourselves as a business, and we want to help our customers on that journey. This is relevant, by the way. And you know, unfortunately, most of our customers are precluded from the net zero journey because they can't afford so-called 100% renewable energy, which I have a problem with anyway, because a lot of it is just greenwashing, but we'll park that for now. And you know who you are, suppliers. But so that's why we do the Energy High Five stuff and that. So, okay, if you can't afford expensive green energy tariffs, you can at least, you know, do your bit and turn lights off and don't fill the kettle up when you're making a cup of tea to save energy. That's the education piece. But we're now moving Utility and this country, but Utility is now taking the lead in things like solar and heat pumps and all that kind of stuff, which is obviously the natural step. The reason we haven't really done this before is there's a number of reasons which I can't really go into, but essentially, you know, it's been very cost prohibitive to do things like solar panels and what have you. And we're now in that sweet spot where actually solar, the prices are coming down, the panels are much lighter and much more powerful. So when we were talking to David Mann and his team and Rod, the chairman and owner, we were talking about, you know, what's your green journey? How do you see things panning out? And we discussed at length about, you know, well, should we think about solar power now? And they were kind of in agreement. So we did some feasibility studies. And this is the lovely thing about what we're doing at Hampshire, is that we're going to be installing 1,100 solar panels as part of the partnership, which is going to reduce their energy consumption, or their energy bills are going to, I mean, there's a 7-figure saving there if you're talking brass tacks immediately. And that does matter. Obviously, their carbon footprint, I think we're saving 90 tons a year on their carbon footprint in one fell sweep as well. About sort of, you know, 25% of the energy from the Shane Warne stand, I think, don't quote me on that, but I think is now going to be green. It's going to be solar. So all of these things are really, really positive. So, you know, the naming rights is a huge thrill for us, and we're delighted to do it. But I'll be honest with you, I was almost more interested in what we can do to leave a legacy. And what I like is, if we're with them for another 12 years, and I think we've initially signed a 7-year partnership with them, I think, if we're with them for 12 years like Ageas, and we walk away after 12 years and we've had a brilliant partnership and someone else steps in, we are still going to have a positive impact on Hampshire cricket long after we've gone. We're going to be reducing the carbon footprint significantly, and we're going to be saving the facility an awful lot of money. And that, for me, is a wonderful legacy, and it's going to happen. So that was our thinking. It just happened to be local. But certainly moving on, we are talking at the moment to about 15 sports clubs about solar, and we're hoping to make some announcements over the next few months. Because, and I urge, if you, you know, if your ops directors of football clubs, rugby clubs, cricket clubs, wherever, you know, you get on board with it, because now it's affordable and will make a huge impact on your carbon footprint. And if any CFOs who are listening, and let's face it, it's all about money with you guys, it will save you an awful lot of money on your energy bills. I won't name them, but I will just add, you know, we're talking to a couple of big football clubs at the moment, and the savings on their energy bills were north of £4.5 million. So that should prick the ears of any CFO listening in.
Does that mean you're going into, because you're entirely domestic, aren't you, in terms of your customer base?
No, we're not. No, we've got about...
You're not? Okay.
We've got 15,000 to 20,000 business customers, maybe a bit less now, I'm not quite sure. But we do have a business arm, absolutely. But this is very, very, I mean, there's a lot of things happening which will become apparent over the next few weeks at Utilita. There's a bit of a restructure and all the rest of it, which I can't tell you too much now about, but it will come out evident. And certainly our renewables arm is going to be a key part, and that will be domestic and commercial. But certainly we're looking at commercial premises, and particularly, as I said, I can't stress this enough, sports clubs, football clubs, cricket clubs, rugby union clubs. What amazes me at the moment, I spoke to one Premier League football club not so long ago, and I said, oh, can we speak to your head of sustainability? We don't have one. And there was a sort of shrug of the shoulders. Okay, what are your net zero plans? What? Really? This is 2024, guys. We've got to really get with the program here. And so I think at the moment, football and sport generally, but I think it's lagging way behind. And I find it amazing. You know, football is quick to jump on lots of brilliant causes, and I'm all on board with that. But energy and the net zero aspirations of football clubs, I think, is dire at the moment. It seems to be a box-ticking exercise to some, and others just literally stare at you and have nothing to say. So get on board with it. And if it is, and if the concern is about financials, trust me, you'll be surprised. You know, these things, your return on investment, you'll get back in 4 or 5 years a lot of the time. But you'll be saving millions and doing a very good thing for the environment.
There's a couple of things in there that I was just, again, forming a question on the go. This is a bit like, you've got sports relationship to this question more generally. You've got, like, you know, can it sustain major events? They're getting bigger, the World Cup in America, more journeys, more teams, more players. It's that question at the top level, which then you move down, and I don't know whether it's complacency or resistance or just, you know, ignorance or whatever, in terms of not having targets, not being part of that conversation. So it's really interesting, your reflection of the sports industry looking back. The other bit that I had in my mind was, and it's the classic greenwashing question in terms of, well, how do I tell the difference? If I'm a punter, I'm swamped with greenwashing. And you know, and everyone becomes then, it raises their cynicism levels. And then you start to say, well, actually, well, the good work then doesn't get through because it clouds, that's the whole point of the clouds everything. So a message with real change and impact investment case attached, it's quite difficult to fight your way through all of the overclaims that are being made all over the place by, you know, everyone else.
Well, with solar, it's very black and white. It's solar energy. We can tell you, to the final percentage point, what percentage of your energy is going to be solar, what those savings are. We're doing a lot of feasibility studies from League One clubs, League Two clubs, Premier League clubs, Scottish clubs. We are working across the board. The point you make though about greenwashing, I think, is very, very important. And unfortunately, there is a fair bit of greenwashing out there, and there's a lot of smoke and mirrors, and people want to look good. I still have a very jaundiced view of a lot of these 100% renewable tariffs that are out there at the moment. Not all. There are some very good companies out there. I think Good Energy are terrific, for example. And if you want to look up, if people aren't completely sure what greenwashing is, Google Good Energy and greenwashing, because they did a brilliant video about a year and a half ago. It's 2 minutes long, and even I can understand it. You know, I've got the attention span on that. So, but it's really good, and explains it in very simple sort of, you know, layman's terms, which is always the best way. But you're right. The problem is that there are an awful lot of claims out there at the moment. And, you know, you've got to take some of these things with a pinch of salt. I'll just go back to what I said, though. Things like solar, though, I mean, you know, we're now in a position as a country, you know, just Utilita, where, you know, solar is now entering no-brainer territory. And the results and everything are absolutely tangible and completely open. And I'll just say, I'll repeat what I said. I would urge ops directors, CFOs, whatever, to really look at it. And by all means, get in contact with me. You know, we'll have to have a conversation as well.
I was talking with Henry Stalens, who, you know, used to be the CEO of Forest Green Rovers. And he was saying, obviously, they're a leader in the field. And he was saying what he couldn't believe was the kind of the basic steps to getting yourself kind of in the running are very simple, and an energy supply for a club is right at the top of the list, or right near the top of the list. And he's saying there's about two or three things you need to do, but energy supply is one of them. So it is strange that, especially with all of the stadia perfect for solar power, it's surprising that so few have gone down that route. Well, so that sounds like some interesting conversation.
It's high energy usage and lots of roof space. If you use a lot of energy and you've got big roof space, it doesn't matter where you are, you know. And people worrying as hell, there's not much sun in this country. Trust me. You know, actually, it's interesting. I was talking to our head of solar the other day, and we were talking about a football stadium. And they said to us, because they're quite far north, they said, are we going to get much sun? And my head of solar said, look, 2 or 3 hours a day, you don't even need sun. It's just light. And the power of these solar panels now, it's so effective and so strong. It will literally, his words, suck up the energy. So, you know, absolutely. It's something that we really need to look at. I'd also add as well, I've spoken to a few football clubs and sports clubs who are still using diesel generators to power those huge lights, you know, the big lights they have to mimic the sun at 3 a.m. A lot of those things have been powered on diesel generators, which frankly blows my mind. And if you're doing that, then look, have a long, hard look at yourselves, guys, because that is not good for the environment. And you'll be surprised at some of the football clubs that are doing that as well.
Okay. Right. Well, listen, it's been fascinating. Has anyone ever said that you look a little bit like a young, better looking Ange Postecoglou?
Do you know what? Ange is in that very thin band of Spurs people I really like. You know, Gary Mavis.
And, you know, it's meant as a compliment. It's like, it's not.
No, you know. No, they've never. I had Jason Cundy a few times, but, you know, no, I haven't. But thank you. I'll take that as a compliment from a Spurs fan.
Stick with Ange.
And we love Ange. He's, you know, even as an Arsenal fan, he's been a breath of fresh air, hasn't he?
Brilliant. Right, Jem, Sean, thanks so much for your time. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
And good luck with it. And we'll keep in touch. I'm sure you'll get swamped with people asking the energy question. So look forward to that.
We are an open book, you two. So please come and we're happy to talk to you.
Brilliant. Cheers, Sean.
Cool. Thanks.
Cheers.
See you, Jim.
Thanks. Nice. Cheers, guys.